Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back. And it is now or never. I do all the time, and it takes up a lot of time out of the content, so let me just move forward with bringing Paul back on board. As always, Paul, it just seems like either the time slips away. You know, these are long segments. These are like 25-minute segments that we do, and before you know it, where did that time go?
Yeah, well, it's a lot of, I don't know if the right word is heady material, and with people who were very well versed in and exercised in what they were doing, it takes some time to understand.
Right. Okay. So one of the things that we were going through yesterday, and I want to just get back on track so that we can cover more content. This is John Marshall, and this was his commentary on the 20th of June. And this actually happens to be a long thread where he's talking about federal jurisdiction. And then this is the part where he actually comes into this, you know, this comment, you know, about the government making laws and so forth. And so anyway, it's coming up in the third paragraph you're going to read, and it's highlighted in green, but this is really important because here he is. So, folks, when you have a direct contradiction, and this happened with Hamilton, and Hamilton really made, as I've told you before, Hamilton's comments in the Federalist Papers were very strong and were very, they were alluding to these defined definitions and terms of this limited government. Once the government was formed, he started using his legal speak of implied powers and that they could do, you know, these implications within the document allowed us to lend into doing these other things. And so the best way I've heard this is by Thomas Woods. I think most people have heard of him. He's an author of the day, and he wrote Nullification and so forth. And he actually got me looking into things that he was talking about where I realized that he missed some points. But nevertheless, Thomas Woods really poses the point this way. Which are we to believe? The words when somebody creates is such a drastic contrast between, you know, what they said in the ratification base. Now, he actually used the words the Federalist Papers instead of what Thomas Woods said. Basically, he was talking about Hamilton. Are we to believe what Hamilton said in the Federalist Papers more than what he said in trying to obtain latitude with the Constitution, which was more correct? And so he was making this point that, you know, here we should actually look at what he was saying in the Federalist Papers. But more importantly, if he understood the legal ramifications of the ratification debates, that under that testimony, these are actually legally binding assertions in stipulating that this is what the Constitution means. Mm-hmm. And so therefore, when we really
Hamilton knew that,
and I'm surprised because I believe Thomas Woods has a degree or at least has studied law. He should have understood this. But my point is this, folks. John Marshall knew this, and John Marshall made comments, very hard, arduous comments in the ratification debates, and we're going to read one of those that is absolutely the, I'll just say it completely liquefies and washes away any of his words as he spoke as a judge. Because when it comes down to which words we have that are actually legally binding, the words in the ratification debates are opinions are not legally binding. They're opinions. And so when he was stating his opinions in the rulings or in the opinions of the cases based on the ruling he made, every word he says is gibber. It's drivel. And the mistake we make is, oh, well, when the judges make these opinions, that is tantamount to law. And that is absolutely wrong. There is nowhere in the Constitution that a jurist's opinion becomes law. And as a matter of fact, the Constitution is very clear that the legislative powers are vested solely in the legislative body, or in the Congress, period, in your state legislature. Go ahead.
In other words, the Supreme Court makes opinions, not law.
And somehow, you know, they've gotten away with, and we've all, this, if everybody just woke up to this one epiphany, because actually, who's the last justice that they just added? Jefferson, Kennedy, Jackson, something like that.
It's Ketanji Brown Jackson.
Okay, thank you. And she was being grilled in the Senate for, you know, this concept of does the judiciary have the authority to make law? Or was it her or was it somebody else that was asked? I think it was, no, it was one of Trump's judges. They were really grilling this point that if, you know, is the judiciary rulings law?
And maybe Kavanaugh.
Yeah, I think it was Kavanaugh. And because the progressives, I think it was Feinstein that was making this point that, you know, when the judges make, you know, when they make a ruling, that becomes law. And she wanted to make sure that he couldn't revoke the laws of other judges.
Right.
Right. Because that's what they were afraid of. And he actually agreed that, though, you know, when a judge makes those laws, that, you know, that becomes law. And that's absolutely wrong. I mean, those words right there in the official capacity as a senator, Feinstein should have been grabbed with a shepherd's hook, dragged out of the room. I don't care if she was kicking and flailing, and if she got injured, she should have been tried for treason right there because she was directly subverting the Constitution. The judiciary has no authority to make law.
Mm-hmm.
And I know I get really passionate about this, but folks, that's how evil these people are. They are making the assertions that day is night and night is day, that good is evil and evil is good. That's how blatant this has become. So anyway. Yeah. Anyway, forgive me for getting riled up like this. And I know that when we have our meetings, you know, whether it be national meeting or state meeting or what have you, I know I get down this path of getting really, really passionate. And so forgive me.
Well, here we go.
There we
go. John Marshall's words, right?
Thank you so much. Yes.
Okay. So here's where we left off, I think.
Go ahead. Yes. The principle.
The principle on which they object to the federal jurisdiction seems to me to be founded on a belief that there will not be a fair trial had in those courts. If this committee will consider it fully, it will find it has no foundation and that we are as secure there as anywhere else. What mischief results from some causes being tried there? Is there not the utmost reason to conclude that judges wisely appointed and independent in their office will never countenance any unfair trial? What are the subjects of its jurisdiction? Let us examine them with an expectation that causes will be as candidly tried there as elsewhere and then determine. The objection, which was made by the honorable member who was first up yesterday, Mr. Mason, has been so fully refuted that it is not worthwhile to notice it. He objected to Congress having power to create a number of inferior courts according to the necessity of public circumstances. I had an apprehension that those gentlemen who placed no confidence in Congress would object that there might be no inferior courts. I own that I thought those gentlemen would think there would be no inferior courts as it depended on the will of Congress, but that we should be dragged to the center of the Union. But I did not conceive that the power of increasing the number of courts could be objected to by any gentleman, as it would remove the inconvenience of being dragged to the center of the United States. I own that the power of creating a number of courts is, in my estimation, so far from being a defect that it seems necessary to the perfection of the system. After having objected to the number and mode, he objected to the subject matter of their cognizance. Here, Mr. Marshall read the second section.
Okay, so let me interject here. The okay. second section that they're talking about is Article 3, Section 2. This is the jurisdiction, and I think it's really, really important that we actually dive into this, excuse me, right now at this time, because when we look at Article 3, Section 2, this is what it says. The power, or the judicial power shall extend to all cases in law and equity arising under this Constitution, the laws of the United States, and treaties made or which shall be made under their authority, to all cases affecting ambassadors, ministers, consuls. So this is what they're saying, and then the 11th Amendment made some changes to this, but he's clearly laying out this is the jurisdiction of the court. Okay? So now he read that, and now he says this, because this is where the highlight is coming up.
Okay. These, sir, excuse me a minute.
Sure.
Yeah, I'm just gonna sneeze. So
okay. All right. So
why don't you take that for a minute?
Yeah, I'll go ahead and do this. These, sir, are the points of federal jurisdiction to which he objects. With a few exceptions, let us examine each of them with the supposition that the same impartiality will be observed there as in other courts, and then see if any mischief will result from them. With respect to its cognizance, in all cases arising under the Constitution and the laws of the United States, he says that the laws of the United States being paramount to the laws of the particular states, that there is no case by which this will extend to. I'm going to actually add something here because he was
okay,
started off.
Back.
Okay, that's fine. He started off saying that with respect to the cognizance in all cases arising under this Constitution, I think the important part is to continue on in actually reading that part of the Constitution where it says, shall extend to the laws of the United States and treaties made or which shall be made under their authority. As a matter of fact, in my color-coded Constitution, or which shall be made under their authority. So in other words, the only laws that they have jurisdiction over are the few laws that are within the Constitution's enumerated powers. And so this kind of gets glossed over a little bit because I don't think he really highlighted this very well, but that is critical because remember, they have jurisdiction over all laws or all things arising under this Constitution or these laws and things under their authority, as just like the Supremacy Clause says. In other words, they can't have a treaty. They can't get involved in a treaty if the Constitution didn't give them the authority to, you know, make a treaty to subjugate us to the UN. That is an unconstitutional law. And so where is the court actually standing up and saying, hey, you can't have this law. That treaty is void. You don't have the authority to do that. And they're not doing that. But this is what he says. And he goes on. Has the government of the United States the power? I just want to make sure. I'll just pick it up with what I think I might have left off with a little ahead of that.
You're in the right place.
Okay. With respect to the cognizance in all cases, I want to lead into it. With respect to all cognizance in all cases arising under the Constitution and laws of the United States, he says that the laws of the United States being paramount to the laws of the particular states, there is no case but what this will extend to. Has the government of the United States power to make laws on every subject? Does he understand it so? Can they make laws affecting the mode of transferring property or contracts or claims? Because these laws don't exist. The power does not exist within the Constitution. He's actually giving us cases that are not within the Constitution. And how many times has the federal government since its you know, creation, its inception and creation, how many times have they actually stepped in and affected the modes of transferring property, contracts, and claims? In other words, when they do these things, they're actually violating the Constitution. And he says, between citizens of the same state, Can they go beyond the delegated powers if they, the federal government, were to make law and make a law not warranted by any of the powers enumerated? It would be considered by the judges as an infringement of the Constitution, which they are to guard. They would not consider such a law as coming under their jurisdiction. They would declare it void. What happened? So what he actually, let me finish the last of this. Okay. It will annihilate the state courts, saying that the honorable gentleman, does not every gentleman here know that the causes in our courts are more numerous than they can decide according to their present construction? Look at the dockets. You will find them crowded with suits, which the life of man will not see determined. If some of these suits be carried to another court, to other courts, will it be wrong? They will have business enough. So he's just trying to make sure that they understand, hey, your courts aren't going to go out of business. They're going to stay in business. We're just going to be taking those ones that will actually, you know, be more proper for the federal court to do. And I, you know, as you can tell, I get very emphatic when I read this, because here Marshall actually convicts himself later on, because these words he stated right here actually ring against him as an indictment of how he violated the Constitution that he defined to the states. So when we talk about it, I'm circling back around. When we talk about Hamilton or other people, you know, that when they make these comments that say, you know, which comment, when you have a contradiction between, you know, they saying this in the ratification debates and these in their opinions, this right here is a legally binding, affixed definition to the Constitution regarding the limitation of jurisdiction of the court and the limited jurisdiction of the federal government. So when he says, oh, well, the federal government has the jurisdiction, he actually, in Marbury v. Madison, said, we don't have the jurisdiction, but we're going to rule on it anyway. He right there in Madison, in Marbury v. Madison, actually violated his terms and definitions that are affixed to this very Constitution.
And imagine that.
Right. So this is why a good friend of mine, I'm going to plug his book here, and I forget what the name of the book is, but it's something like The Seven Biggest Liars That Did More Damage to Our Constitution Than Anybody Else. And John Marshall was, I believe, the number one. So wow. Most people don't even realize, because they think this guy was a brilliant man, but his lies created footings for the federal government to start assuming precedence in case law, which they had no authority to do, and actually started moving everything down this path so that when the Organic Act came along, it just took us sideways. And that's why we've been sliding down this hill, and we're on the precipice. Anyway, mm-hmm. I'm sorry for taking that from you, but you know.
No, that's okay.
I hope the sneeze went well. We missed it, and I hope it really got the evil out of you.
I muted so it wouldn't interrupt you, and I'm okay now. All right. If I
No, it's okay. It's okay.
Yeah, that's okay. If one gets past me, I'll mute and just take over.
I get it. They actually call that a cough button in radio. You just push the button and it does away with 5 seconds. Anyway.
Yeah. Okay.
Go ahead.
So let's see. The next note. There's another note here.
Yep. And then common law. Yep.
Okay. So here we go. How disgraceful is it that the state courts cannot be trusted? Is he asking a question here? Oh, he's quoting someone, says the honorable gentleman. What is the language of the Constitution? Does it take away their jurisdiction? Is it not necessary that the federal court should have cognizance of cases arising under the Constitution and the laws of the United States? What is the service of purpose of a judiciary but to execute the laws in a peaceable, orderly manner without shedding blood or creating a contest or availing yourselves of force? If this be the case, where in its jurisdiction be more necessary than here? You want to touch that for just a minute? I think the last couple sentences were a little confusing, or the last one was.
Okay, so he's basically trying to argue the, you know, why would anybody think that, you know, the state courts couldn't be trusted or making this presumption, or more importantly, why would somebody not think that it would be more appropriate to try things of a national nature within the federal courts instead of the state courts? Because currently, under the Articles of Confederation, they didn't have a Supreme Court. The state courts did it all.
Oh.
Ah. And they were creating a whole new court system. This Constitution, you know, took the magistrate and divided the roles and responsibilities of a magistrate by separating legislative powers into a legislative branch. This is why I tell you that this Republican form of government is very unique.
Oh, got it.
Okay. All right.
All right. So now he goes on to common law.
There you go.
All right. To what quarter will you look for protection from an infringement on the Constitution if you will not give the power to the judiciary? There's no other body that can afford such a protection, but the honorable member objects to it because he says that the officers of government will be screened from merited punishment by the federal judiciary. Okay, he's making a... What's the argument that people are giving that he's referring to here? He says that the officers of the government will be screened for merited punishment by a federal judiciary. Okay, he goes on, I guess.
Yeah. So he put, yeah. Right. He speaks. He speaks in a way that really throws people off because, like I said, there's other cultures that speak like this. Not many people, you know, can kind of keep up with the way he questions and then goes on to answering in an oblique way, but. He's actually he's kind of quoting or paraphrasing the other person and saying, because he says that the officers will be screened from merit, be preserved or protected from merited punishment by the federal judiciary. In other words, they're the other hand that's going to protect each other.
Okay. All right. So here he goes on. And you highlight this word, sheriff. The federal sheriff, says he, will go into a poor man's house and beat him or abuse his family, and the federal court will protect him. Does any gentleman believe this? Is it necessary that the officers will commit a trespass on the property or persons of those with whom they are to transact business? Will such great insults on the people of this country be allowable were a law made to authorize them? It would be void.
Okay. Now, the Constitution has already stipulated that the enforcement of laws was to be done by whom?
By the militia.
By the militia. That these federal sheriffs would only be agents in working with the law enforcement. They have no cognizance. They're civilian authority speaking with the sheriffs. And technically, when we look at the fact of what's been happening with the FBI, you know, knocking down doors, going into Trump's tower, or all these different things, they don't have the authority to do that. And what he's talking about is he's talking about something that the federal government would be doing that he's basically paraphrasing that these people, these anti-federalists, are imagining an authority and power that does not exist within this Constitution. They won't be able to kick in the doors. That has to be done by your militia. It is going to be your neighbors that will kick in your doors if necessary to enforce the laws or execute the laws of the union. We got 5 seconds, so Paul, just hold on. We've got our mid-break here coming up, and we'll be back with you. But folks, I hope you're starting to understand how, you know, I know it's difficult reading, Marshall, but when we really look at, you know, some of these arguments that he's making, I'm really trying to highlight, you know, some clarity to jurisdiction, common law, these other things. But it's also an indictment on Marshall and his behavior as a Supreme Court justice.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
Friends, if you have any questions or comments, we have our 24-hour comment line at 425-270-5416.
Okay, so getting back to the content that Marshall's giving us, you know, he's really laying out some very good points here. But again, like I said, when you really look at what he says and then what he does and says in his opinions as a Supreme Court justice, there's a huge contrast. And Hamilton, As we go through the New York debates, you're going to kind of see where I think Hamilton speaks very lightly to these topics. He's not nearly as heavy-handed as he was in the Federalist Papers. And there's a reason for that, because he knew, as, you know, I think as everything was playing out, I think he knew that he would have a place in government. You know, he had already nurtured the relationship with Madison. He's nurtured the relationship with George Washington. And so he knew that he had a high level of confidence in very powerful men throughout the nation. I don't know if everybody knows, but, you know, he was a bastard. In other words, he was born into a circumstance where his father abandoned him. I mean, I don't even think he knew his father. I think he finally met his father after he, you know, came to America and did some business and then went back to the whatever islands it was that he came from. I forget. But bottom line, here was a guy that, you know, his mom was not well-to-do at all. He was poor. He was illiterate. And he came to America and literally redefined himself and built himself up with being one of the most literate men in America. The only person that I believe, he, you know, cast a shadow over him was James Madison. That's how literate and how respected he was. But he started taking latitude after the Constitutional Convention, and he went sideways. This is when he started his sordid affair with, you know, a married woman, and did a lot of things that you just go, why? You know, he had all of these things that were in his advantage. Why did he go down that path? Anyway. I that's maybe some analysis and conjecture for another point in time, but you don't get these types of things when you watch these, you know, these Hollywood or these Broadway shows like Hamilton. You know, they just want you to think that this guy was, you know, a brilliant, great guy, and then they build on some of his bad arguments that, you know, we're supposed to have this big, powerful government that does everything for us. Anyway. Go ahead and pick up where you left off. My apologies.
Okay.
So you start. You being pick up with the injured man would trust, because you just finished the green part.
Okay.
Right? Okay.
That's fine. The injured man would trust to a tribunal in his neighborhood. To such a tribunal, he would apply for redress and get it. There's no reason to fear that he would not meet that justice there which his country will be ever willing to maintain. But on appeal, says the honorable gentleman, that which is there What chance is there to obtain justice? This is founded on an idea that they will not be impartial. There is no clause in the Constitution which bars the individual member injured from applying to the state courts to give him redress. He says that there is no instance of appeals as to fact in common law cases. The contrary is well known to you, Mr. Chairman, to be the case in this Commonwealth. With respect to Mills, Rhodes, and other excuse me, with respect to Mills, Rhodes, and other cases, appeals lie the inferior to the superior court as to fact as well as law. Is it a clear case that there can be no case in common law in which an appeal as to fact might be proper and necessary? Can you not conceive a case where it would be productive of advantages to the people at large to submit to that tribunal the final determination involving fact as well as law? Suppose it should be deemed for the convenience of the citizens that those things which concern foreign which concern foreign ministers should be tried in the inferior courts. If justice could be done, the decision would satisfy all. But if an appeal in matters of facts could not be carried to the superior court, then it would result that such cases could not be tried before the inferior courts for fear of injurious and partial decisions. Again, a mouthful.
Yes, absolutely. But he makes a very good point that, you know, if you take away the opportunity of the appeal to the superior court, then all of a sudden they could become very biased or very partial down to the inferior courts where justice could not be had.
Right. Okay. But, sir, where is the necessity of discriminating between the three cases of chancery, admiralty, and common law? Why not leave it to Congress? Will it enlarge their powers? Is it necessary for them wantonly to infringe your rights? Have you anything to apprehend when they can in no case abuse their power without rendering themselves hateful to the people at large? When this is the case, something may be left to the legislature freely chosen by ourselves from among ourselves, who are to share the burdens imposed upon the community and who can be changed at our pleasure. Where power may be trusted and there is no motive to abuse it, it seems to me as well to leave it undetermined as to fix it in the Constitution. So what is it he wants to leave undetermined?
Okay, so I believe it's trying to say that they want to fix, because... What he starts off with is he starts talking about the necessity of discriminating between the three cases of chancery, admiralty, and common law. Why not leave it to Congress? Will it enlarge their powers? Is it necessary for them wantonly to infringe your rights? Have you anything to apprehend when they can in no case abuse their power without rendering themselves hateful to the people at large? So in other words, Congress has this power to do that. What do we want to really change that? The real fact is, and the reality is, because he makes a good point. You know, if they're going to create, when Congress starts becoming tyrannical and they start operating outside these limited powers, then the people start hating them. But
right. Oh, no kidding.
And we see that.
Right.
I mean, we see that.
Right.
But again, the argument or the preposition is what they're doing constitutional. They take the risk if they violate the Constitution that the people will hate them. So right. What do they need to do? And I'm going to put this into context for today because people hate Congress. Congress is the most hated entity out of the three branches of government, right? It has the lowest opinion right. among people. Well, why? And why is it that we're not actually getting it? Because of our illiteracy and ignorance of the Constitution. See, the only reason why we're not fixing the problem is because we don't understand. We actually believe, America believes that they can do these things. They believe that the Democrats and the Republicans have decided we're going to have a health care and they can get away with it, when it is an outright, palpable, blatant violation of the Constitution.
Right.
So, You know, it's not about just hating them. It's about actually trying them for insurrection, trying them for treason against the Constitution. We have gone so far beyond that line that it's not about hating them anymore. We must seek justice and we must reclaim our constitutional republic. We have to do this. If we don't, what they're doing to us will destroy us. This is not hyperbole, folks. I know that Jefferson, in his resolutions of 1798, got a little bit, you know, kind of became a drama queen when he said that, you know, these laws are going to lead to our destruction. Well, obviously, you know, they didn't help. But when we look at the intricate webbing and the warfare that they're using behind this webbing against us right now, to they're actually acting out to destroy us. And so where is the hate? Well, yeah, everybody hates them, but they don't know what and how to focus that hate. Stop hating. Get smart and hold them accountable. And put the hate aside. I talk about this regarding the election. What America wants is they want vengeance. And they're idiots for this. What we want and what we should be wanting is compliance. And we, if we were smart, we would know exactly how easy it would be to get them into compliance by using First Amendment petitions and demanding, you know, auditing them in every capacity, proving how everything that they're doing is all unconstitutional and dismantling this Leviathan that they've created. And that process is literally kicks off with the First Amendment petitions. It starts restoring constitutional counties, restoring common law, restoring all of these things, getting states constitutional, and initiating republic review. I mean, this is the thorough, you know, at a very high level, this is the thorough process that you're getting this here. This is not entertainment, folks. We're connecting the dots and helping you understand the, you know, as you start understanding these small little things, you can start seeing the bigger picture. But what he's talking about here is that these are, you know, when Congress does these things, that they're going to be hated. Well, they're going to be hated because they're violating the law.
Right. And the results of that show, because it hurts the people.
Right. Right. Okay. So he's basically, you know, sets up the final speaker of the day, which is Governor Randolph, and then they go into Saturday. Yes, they work on Saturday. And so Mr. Grayson speaks on Saturday the 21st, and just keep in mind that Mr. Grayson isn't the brightest bulb on the tree, but he happens to be one of the anti-federalist spokesmen. And so this is a comment that he makes regarding common law. That, again, if we really examine what he's saying, is what he's saying something that's really founded within the Constitution, or is this a subversive view of, you know, how the Constitution would actually be in violation, or the government would be in violation of the Constitution? So I'll let you, you know, choose. As you read this, you tell me, you know, where is he standing, and is he really giving you an accurate picture? So go ahead.
Okay, so this is Mr. Grayson, Common Law, June 21st, right?
Yep.
All right. There's to be for Chancery, Admiralty, Common Pleas, and Exchequer, which graded in England to four great courts, to which are added
Hold on a quick second. There was a little bit of a bad connection, so you kind of went out and off and on and off and on. And so I think you finally got there. So the very first part of what you said kind of got lost. So please repeat it, because the content is really important. So go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah, sure. Are you hearing me okay now?
Yeah, a little. It's not as bad as it was. I mean, you completely cut out there at the beginning.
Okay, let me go back.
Okay.
There is to be one Supreme Court for Chancery, Admiralty, Common Pleas, and Exchequer, which great eases are left in England to four great courts, to which are added criminal jurisdiction and all cases depending on the law of nations, a most extensive jurisdiction. This court has more power than any court under heaven. One set of judges ought not to have this power, and judges particular who have temptation always before their eyes, The court thus organized are to execute laws made by 13 nations dissimilar in their customs, manners, laws, and interests. If we advert to the customs of these different sovereignties, we shall find them repugnant and dissimilar. Yet they are all forced to unite and concur in making these laws. They are to form them on one principle and on one idea, whether the civil law, common law, or law of nations. The gentleman was driven the other day to the expedient of acknowledging the necessity of having 13 different tax laws. This destroys the principle that he who lays a tax should feel it and bear his proportion of it. This has not been answered. It will involve consequences so absurd that I presume they will not attempt to make 13 different codes. They will be obliged to make one code. How will they make one code without being contradictory to some of the laws of the different states?
Okay, so Mr. Grayson, well, what do you think before I pollute the pool?
Well, I think my first impression is that I don't want to be unkind. I just wonder if he's been listening through the entire debates. I don't think he's on track. Okay, that's the best way I can put it in the short terms, and I think maybe in the time we have left.
Okay, so let me read the very last part of what he says, and mm-hmm. to just prove how he does not understand. And this is what he says. This has not been answered. He makes his point that this destroys the principle that he who lays a tax should feel it and bear its proportion. This has not been answered. It will involve consequences so absurd that I presume they will not attempt to make 13 different codes. They will be obliged to make one code. How will they make one code without being contradictory to some of the laws of the different states? Now, what does the Constitution say? If Mr. Grayson understands the uniformity clause, which was actually read several times in the ratification debates, where does he get off thinking that they have to make 13 separate codes? They can't. Does that
right.
make
I
sense?
I don't know where he's getting that
from. So, in other words, he's making arguments that say they have to deal with us like the Confederation has to deal with us. In other words, he's ignoring what, you know, the whole essence of what this Constitution is to do. And he's making these suppositions throughout this and other points that he's actually making really unfounded comments and unfounded arguments. They're that unfounded. And like I said, out of all of the anti-federalists, Grayson was one of those guys that, you know, I'd listen to him and I'd go, you know, I just feel embarrassed.
It sounds as though his head is still in the Articles of Confederation.
Yes, very much so. And as a matter of fact, that kind of points out, you know, how when they talk about this new judiciary, that, you know, this judiciary is completely in defiance to, you know, what they've currently had, because the states actually had all judiciary control.
Right.
The Confederation never had any judiciary.
Okay.
Right. And so this was a huge surrendering of power. So some of the things that really became, you know, one of the big contentions was this new government would take away, you know, all of the power that the states had regarding the judiciary and regarding some taxation. But when we look at it, you know, had everything been confined and had they acted within the Constitution, we didn't have men like John Marshall that started taking latitude, like Hamilton. But, you know, and again, we've read through several times that men will be men. Men will try mm-hmm. to do these things. It doesn't mean that we shouldn't give these powers. We just have to right. be guarded to hold these men in check. Folks, mm-hmm. the reason we're so far off this path is because our forefathers, your parents, your grandparents, have failed to hold the government in check. Is this the generation that will do it? If not you, then who? If not now, then when? There you go. All right.
Okay.
All right. So, thank you. All right.
How are we doing for time?
We're down to about 8 minutes. And so we're actually going to cruise down to...
commission?
Yes, we're down to Mr. Monroe's commission, correct.
Okay. Let's see what we got here. Okay, well, I think we can do this in 8 minutes.
Well, we can at least, try to move forward.
Get it started.
Go ahead.
Yeah. Okay. Mr. Monroe, he could not conceive that a conditional ratification would, in the most remote degree, endanger the Union, for that it was as clearly the interest of the adopting states to be united with Virginia as it could be her interest to be in union with them. He demanded if they would arm the states against one another and make themselves enemies of those who were respectable and powerful from their situation and numbers, he had no doubt that they would, in preference to such a desperate and violent measure, come forward and make a proposition to the other states so far as it would be consistent with the general interest. Adopt it now, unconditionally, says he, and it will never be amended, not even when experience shall have proved its defects. An alteration will be a diminution of their power, and there will be great exertions made to prevent it. I have no dread that they will immediately infringe the dearest rights of the people, but that the operation of the government will be oppressive in process of time. Shall we not pursue the dictates of common sense and the example of all free and wise nations and insist on amendments with manly fortitude? It is urged that there is an impossibility of getting previous amendments and that a variety of circumstances can concur to render it impracticable. This argument appears to me fallacious and as a specious invasion. The same cause which has hitherto produced a spirit of unanimity and a predilection for the Union will hereafter produce the same effects. How did the Federal Convention meet? From the beginning of time, in any age or country, did ever men meet under so loose, uncurbed a commission? There was nothing to restrain them but their characters and reputation. They could not organize a system without defects. This cannot then be perfect. Is it not presumable that by subsequent attempts, we shall make it more complete and perfect? What are the great objections now made? Are they local? What are the amendments brought forth by my friends? Do they not contemplate the great interests of the people and of the Union at large? I am satisfied from what we have seen of the disposition of the other states that instead of disunion and national confusion, there will be harmony and perfect concord. Disunion is more to be apprehended from the adoption of a system reprobated by some and allowed by all to be defective. The arguments of gentlemen have no weight on my mind. It is unnecessary to enter into the refutation of them. My honorable friends have done it highly to my satisfaction. Permit me only to observe, with respect to those amendments, that they are harmless. Do they change a feature of the Constitution? They secure our rights without altering a single feature. Trust, therefore, the gentlemen will concur with them.
Okay, so actually, this is the point where we really see that Monroe has taken off his anti-federalist armament and has actually become the champion of the Constitution. It may not really jump out at you, but he's here clearly saying that why not ratify this? Why do you think this absurd thought that we can't get amendments? Is it not in our favor? Because, you know, all of the states have basically been saying they want these amendments. Why would they not allow us to amend this? Especially, and he didn't mention this, but especially with the way they've made it so that, you know, it seems like the majority will instantly get these amendments because we have a mechanism of a 3/4 threshold instead of 100%. We will no longer have rogue islands suppressing us and keeping us from being able to move forward. So, but the important part is what he talks about regarding the Federal Convention. And he says here that there was nothing to restrain them but their character and reputation. In other words, when you read the commission, they were told to figure out what they needed to do to fix these deficiencies, even if it meant creating a new system.
Right.
So where do people get off? Because remember, he was an anti-federalist. And prior to this convention, they actually had a formal separate debate regarding the commission, and they took a vote. And the majority of the people there felt and agreed that the delegates did not exceed their authority in the commission. They didn't exceed their commission. So that's why they actually debated the Constitution in all these different states, because that was one of the plans of the anti-federalists to thwart this Constitution so that they could protect their power. And here was an anti-federalist, and I'm telling you, Mason never took an anti-federalist approach where, he voted against it. He may have said, well, we kind of took some latitude, but he was a pretty honorable man. Mm-hmm. And so Randolph didn't sign the Constitution, Governor Randolph, but he never said that they exceeded their commission. Never.
Right.
And so when you look at some of the citations, and because there's some John Birchers out there that have all this list of citations. Well, you count up how many names, and then you count up how many people have been involved in the ratification debates, and it becomes very, very clear that obviously there was not enough anti-federalists with this bad paradigm, because the Constitution could not be stopped by these deceitful views that these guys did something outside of that. And Madison was very clear when he completely refuted this in Federalist Paper 40. And I think it goes on in Federalist Paper 40 and 41. He actually reads what the commission stated. And he says, where is this, where is this finite line that we couldn't have crossed? We were given whatever expediencies necessary to fix the defections of the Confederation. And they did it. And they did it so brilliantly by creating these separations of power, by breaking up this magistrate and moving us away from a form of monarchy into a whole new revolutionary form of government that empowered people and gave us a self-governing system.
Right.
Right. Anyway.
It's an amazing piece of work.
Yes, it is. Now, Mr. Innes is going to talk. We only have a minute left, not even a minute. So Mr. Innes is going to, and it's a short one, but
it's a short paragraph.
Yeah, I'd rather pick this up when we come back, because I'd like to gracefully go out instead of having music start talking over us or playing over us.
All right.
So is there anything that you kind of take away from what we learned today, other than John Marshall speaks very difficultly?
Well, he is a challenging speaker, but he is he also understood the Constitution and described, how should I put this, described it well, in the ratification debates. He judges himself by his own words. And so,
yep.
So we're looking forward to wrapping this up. And now we're going to New York, I guess, after this paragraph is my guess.
Yep,
right?
That is correct. But we need to set the stage before we do that. And so we'll wrap up Virginia, kind of close Virginia. And then we'll kind of talk and set the stage of really what's going on in New York when we come back in our next episode, folks. So, we're here to help create the clarity on this Constitution. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless. The reason progressives are effective in instituting their policies is because they are united ideologically, financially, and socially. In addition, almost every billionaire in the world is funding a vast array of different groups, and these groups' efforts are to undermine our republic and our Constitution. If you don't believe me, just Google donors to the Open Society Foundations. The only way we're going to successfully combat these efforts and take back our liberties, like our education system, health care, state lands, housing, labor, and many other roles, responsibilities and powers that belong to the states, is by you and I and local businesses getting involved and supporting political programs and efforts based on constitutional principles. The best way to do this is supporting result-oriented organizations designed to take back our lost liberties. The ultimate result-oriented effort is Republic Review. So please consider contributing to the show and the organizations and activities that we are supporting by going to reclaimingtherepublic.org and go to the contribution page, and you can become a listed supporter of Liberty.